Raynard S. Kington, the former NIH deputy director who became president of Iowa's Grinnell College in August, stopped by Inside Higher Ed's offices recently to discuss his vision for the college, the future of the liberal arts, and his unusual status in a small Midwestern town as what he called, quote, the gay black dad president, end quote. Excerpts follow.
So what's the transition been like? Uh-huh. As you were moving from, you know, very different institutions, what's your arrival been like? What are your impressions?
Well, it's been a lot of fun and challenging because of a lot of reasons. One, Grinnell is a small town in Iowa, 9,000 people. I mean, I lived in Washington, L.A., New York, Philadelphia, Chicago. I mean, my neighborhoods usually were larger than 9,000 people. So that's been a little getting used to, partly because as a president of a small college in a small town, I'm noticeable, mm-hmm. even without my demographic characteristics, even more noticeable as African American. I mean, so it's hard. It's taking a little while to get used to people sort of literally coming up to me at midnight at Walmart and saying, "You're the president of Grinnell, aren't you?" And just sort of just that part of it. So that's been a challenge, but fun actually. It's been a lot of fun actually. I've just never been recognized before. NIH is a big place, but even the NIH employees, many of them couldn't recognize me, wouldn't have recognized me. So that's part of a change. It's taking a little bit getting used to. No Indian food. Big challenge. I lived in Tacoma Park, where there was great Indian food all over the place, and so that's a real challenge. But with regard to the job, I'm learning a different culture. Small liberal arts colleges are really are communities. I mean, literally, they are sort of communities in which there are sort of traditions and cultural norms and practices that require some learning. Shared governance, which is sort of a core principle of almost all of higher education, but really in liberal arts colleges like Grinnell, is hard work. And getting it right and sort of learning how shared governance works in our particular environment it requires listening a lot, which can be hard to listen a lot, but I'm getting better at it.
Grinnell has been known for having one of the largest endowments among liberal arts colleges, mm-hmm. for many years, which was a great thing until maybe the fall of 2008, when all of a sudden it added some complexity. How do you see the finances of the college, and how much is that a challenge to you?
Well, first of all, we don't want to complain, mm-hmm. because, as you noted, we're fortunate in that, largely due to the efforts of the previous president and the boards of the last 20 or 30 years, has a healthy endowment, which helps us sort of live up to our values, mm-hmm. actually, which is nice. Because of the policies of the previous president and the board sort of enacted and sort of followed, we didn't have as painful a transition as some places did, largely because there were sort of controls on how much sort of increases within any one year could go out, how dependent we were on operating budgets on the endowment. There was a decision made early on to sort of take, when times were going very well, to sort of devote some of the new funds to things that are relatively short term, like catching up on deferred maintenance and buildings and things that wouldn't have long tails. So when the economy tanked, we didn't have to fire people or lay people off. We just sort of stopped those special projects, and we were in a position where we could do that. While we are not in crisis now, mm-hmm. which distinguishes us from many, many, many schools, we are operating now in the same difficult world that all of higher education mm-hmm. is operating in. And, you know, the list of characteristics of this new mm-hmm. world are pretty well known, you know, less robust endowment incomes, students with greater need, challenges in living up to the promises of diversity and everything that that means. You go down the list of sort of the new world, lower fundraising, mm-hmm. More fundraising challenges, and sort of spending more to get less or to stay up, mm-hmm. keep up. So we're trying to figure out where we fit in this new world of higher education. What's good is that because we're not in crisis, we're able to sort of think about it, and that's what we're doing. So our board is working with a number of senior staff to sort of think through sort of how our institution will operate given these new constraints, and where we set all the levers that go into sort of determining the sustainability and viability of the institution for the long haul. And clarifying what are our sort of non-negotiable core principles.
Do you think, I mean, in the past 2 years, there have been a lot of sort of critics or even people within higher ed who've said what we've seen is that the existing economic model doesn't work, or specifically the economic model for the colleges that charge the most in tuition is flawed in some fundamental way. Do you think that?
Well, first of all, as high as tuition is, it still doesn't cover all the costs. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. Second, economically, it's still a good investment, largely due to the continuing separation between the incomes of the people who are educated and the people who aren't educated. So it's still a buy in long term as an investment. I agree, though, that some fundamental dimensions of this model are going to have to be thought about more thoughtfully, so more carefully, rather. For example, I think that there's, and others have said this, that we're, particularly small liberal arts colleges, are going to have to think about how they make the trade-off between depth and breadth. They're going to have to sort of explore ways that they can work closely together and share resources, share infrastructure, for example. Some schools already do this to a fair degree, and I think you'll see more interesting models mm-hmm. like that coming forth. Even the notion of what a comprehensive fee means when you have discount rates at mm-hmm. over 50%, our incoming class discount rate is in the low 60s.
Wow.
Our fee is way below,
mm-hmm.
even below many of our peers, is at the bottom mm-hmm. in terms of, because there was great restraint. Even when we increased several years ago 15% mm-hmm. in 1 year, it still hasn't caught up with many mm-hmm. of our peers. So I think everyone is sort of, each part of higher education is figuring out how their world mm-hmm. is going to work. So the University of California at least
right.
report on the future. I mean, each one is sort of figuring out, okay, how do we operate mm-hmm. in this new world? And our slice, first of all, liberal arts colleges, I think, are sort of separated into those that have a lot of resources and those that are very heavily tuition dependent mm-hmm. on operating. So I think there are going to be different solutions for those two groups of schools. And so we're fortunate that we have a fair number of resources, but we have similar constraints as everyone else, and we're trying to figure out where to set all these levers to make sure that we're sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Many of the elite liberal arts colleges like Grinnell have not rushed into the sharing or the online courses. And while you have some colleges reasonably near, it's not like you've got another college across the street.
Yes,
either.
Yeah, right.
When you think about sharing, are you thinking about online, or are you thinking?
Well, you know, I think, I mean, that's another whole world mm-hmm. of sort of online presence. I can't see us, I think that's a pretty packed market already,
mm-hmm.
With a number of institutions sort of pretty being ahead of the game in lots of ways and being quite successful with mm-hmm. online of learning. So I can't, a key part of our educational experience is residential.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we're going to, I can't see us remaking ourselves to fit a different model. And while I think we will continue, sort of online resources will transform us like it will, as it's transforming everyone else, it won't be in the way that where we start offering lots and lots of online courses. What I think we'll see happen is that online resources will be used in really creative ways to try to expand our educational experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like it may not be necessary to travel to original documents for some mm-hmm. types of research, for example. So although I think the online presence is changing the way we do things, I don't think it'll result in our opening up a whole mm-hmm. new sort of stream of activities related to that as a mm-hmm. source of revenue. What I see it as is a resource to help us rethink and keep up to date with resources, with sort of modern world in terms of how mm-hmm. we teach and what we teach.
So then are you talking about curricular sharing of language in language courses?
I think we have to think creatively about mm-hmm. so that might be an area where we can't offer every language. We offer a lot, but we can't offer every one of them. So and there are ways now to actually have language experiences other than through the traditional ways. I think we're going to have to think creatively. You're right. We're not like Bryn Mawr and Swarthmore, yeah. the cluster of colleges yeah. all near each other right outside of Philadelphia. We don't have a lot of colleges close by. But I think we have to think creatively. There might be ways where we can share resources and or at least even think about approaches that allow us sort of not to replicate and to sort of be complements with other institutions.
Do you feel, we're hearing from a lot of liberal arts college presidents, concern about whether families are so focused on jobs that liberal arts is not valued.
Yeah.
And seeing a bunch of liberal arts colleges, arguably not with Grinnell's stature,
mm-hmm.
adding business majors,
yeah.
focused heavily on those things. How do you think about those issues?
Well, first of all, you know, I was reading a history of the college in the 1800s, and there was that discussion even back then when the land grants were being founded and were being very practically oriented, engineering and science, and so that was the, and to some extent business, but more practical type of applied knowledge activities. And there was a real push even then for Grinnell to sort of change the way we do things. So while we've adapted to the world, we fundamentally have stayed with the idea that a broad-based liberal arts education is a good starting point. And I think that argument is even stronger now for the very reasons that you point out. People are living longer and having multiple careers. The best base is a base that allows you good skills to communicate, to sort of assess new knowledge, to integrate new knowledge into your thinking, and who knows what your job will be 20 years from now. So that while many of the students who for understandable reasons choose to get more specific technical skills, so they're ready, sort of business ready as they leave the college, I understand the pressure to do that. But I think in the long run, a liberal arts education will be better in preparing people for the jobs that we don't even know what their requirements will be out there.
What gives you confidence that your students have those skills?
That's a broad question of how, well, anyone is confident they have any skills, and that leads us to assessment. like other schools, we're in the process now of sort of trying to figure out how we can rigorously assess outcomes. I share the concern that conversation, if carried to an extreme, could fundamentally change what works with our education. But on the other hand, I also recognize that it's not unreasonable to have some way of determining whether or not you're achieving your goal. I was trained in medicine. You know, we had this discussion 20 years ago about mortality rates in hospitals. And we said, oh, you can't tell anything about mortality rates. You sort of, what if you have the sickest patients? And well, that was all true. But you
it's
know
like
what?
The graduation rate decision. Yeah.
Now we actually right. estimate mortality rates, and there's something to it. And sort of, so I think we can. We're going to have to think creatively and rigorously, and think in ways that really achieve the real goal of assessment, which is to sort of help inform what you do, sort of so that you do it in the best way to achieve your goal. We're not doing assessment for assessment's sake. We're trying to do assessment to help actually help us be better. And that's where I think we can, there's room, and we should.
Do you think the conversation has been engaged enough by you and your peer, by your peers, by higher education, or do you think it's still a, has higher education sort of gotten to the point where your view is common, or do you think you're
I think it's getting there. I'm sort of new to this world, but it's, and you know, what I bring is a perspective, in this case, of medicine, where, you know, we had this discussion like 20 years ago, and now there's pretty broad acceptance that you can measure quality of care. You can sort of do these things, and, you know, medicine's pretty complicated, too. So I think we can figure out a way to rigorously assess outcomes in higher education, recognizing that there are lots, sort of the goals are more diffuse in a lot of ways. It's not as, you know, it's sort of, it's
dead
not,
or not.
Right, dead or not and healthy or not. I mean, sort of, it's, although even that is not as, not as cut and dry as you might think. But it's a greater challenge in some ways. But I think we have lots of smart people who want to do a better job. I think we can figure out ways to help develop assessment tools that actually are useful to, and don't become a sort of a bet, you know, that are really helpful in guiding how we adapt to a changing world.
One more question before we turn that off. You mentioned your demographic earlier. When you were appointed, it's still a relative rarity for a gay man to get a presidency, an African-American gay man with a family moving to small town in Iowa without Indian restaurants.
Very small demographic slice there.
What has that, you know, what, is it notable still that, you know, is it something that, what are your thoughts on the experience?
Well, you know, I think I would like if we were in a world where it would not be noticeable or notable or worthy of comment, but we don't live in that world. It would be notable that I'm African American, mm-hmm. that I'm a physician, that I came from a large research setting. I mean, mm-hmm. sort of all those things are all notable. I'm hoping though that. In time, it'll be less notable, and I think that's happening already. Perhaps more importantly, I guess I really, to the extent that it allows some young people to think in different ways about their future, I'm all for being notable. If it sort of helps people, young people think about their futures, I'll give you a case in point. My selection was announced. First of all, one friend of mine said, "I am now the sort of gay black dad president." So that's sort of hyphenated. That's sort of like one concept, and that's me. I got lots of letters and emails, mm-hmm. and I got a great email from an African American teacher in Atlanta who wrote me this note, and he said, "You know, when I was in college, I thought it would be great to be a college president, but I just thought it wasn't doable. Mm-hmm. And now I think it's doable. You know, well, you know, wonderful." So if it sort of allows people to think in different ways, I'm all for that.
I wonder if you might talk about this new award that Grinnell has created.
Well, you know, the school, there's a dictum in creative writing, sort of show, don't tell. Mm-hmm. And we thought a lot about how we could drive home the message to our students and to external audiences about what was unique about the college. And we believe that its long tradition of linking liberal arts education with positive social change, dating to the abolitionist sentiments of our founders, was something that made us distinctive. We thought about lots of ways that we could tell that message, and we decided that one way we could do it was to sort of bring young people who have done really creative things to campus and recognize them. And that's really what this is about. We a starter program that is aimed at recognizing young people under the age of 40. Yes, under the age of 40, who have done creative, innovative things in affecting positive social change, broadly defined. So we want people from all, not just the usual areas of education and civil rights, but also arts and business. And those individuals will receive a cash award, about $50,000 each, and they'll also be able to designate $50,000 that would go to either their organization or organization that does work in their area. Interesting, you know, the cost of a program like this is sort of comparable to many media campaigns in colleges. We think this is a good way for us to show what we're about. We are, it'll be tightly tied to the educational objectives, so students, we're going to start an online journal focusing on young people who are doing really creative things in social change. There'll be a symposium. Prior to the symposium of the people who win the prize, we're going to have a symposium on how to define social justice. We are looking at ways to link sort of winners with students in a range of different ways, such as summer internships and other opportunities to sort of demonstrate to students in a very concrete way what is possible. And the focus is on these individuals who've done creative things. So yes, we see that as a way of telling our story, and it's not the usual way. We think it's the right way for the school.
Uh-huh.